course of our series, The Costs of Higher Ed, we've dedicated segments to the questions of why tuition keeps increasing, what it's spent on, and what kind of labor students do to make it more affordable. For the third and final installment of our series, we're looking at two organizing initiatives currently unfolding at New York City universities, one at Columbia and one at the CUNY Graduate Center. Both fights focus on the precarious nature of graduate student labor. And the fight at the CUNY Graduate Center also encompasses adjunct professors, whose labor disputes can be seen as comparable to those of some graduate students. Here with us to discuss the ongoing efforts to organize labor in higher education are Columbia PhD candidate Tanya Bhattacharya and Sean M. Kennedy, a PhD candidate in English at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. And listeners, are you a graduate student who works as a TA or research assistant, or are you currently an adjunct professor? Call in at 212-433-9692 or tweet us at WNYC Midday with your stories about the nature of your work and if your institution is unionized. Tanya and Sean, welcome.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So, Sean, let's start with you. Tell us about the CUNY system, how long its long history of unionizing. What's the Professional Staff Congress, and when was it formed?
Well, the Professional Staff Congress is the main organizing body, the main union for the professional staff and the faculty of CUNY. It was founded in 1972 out of sort of a complicated merger of two previous entities, and it's been around since then, and it has been really important in trying to resist, you know, the decades decline in state funding and austerity, the deployment of austerity politics, trying to keep students enrolled and trying to increasingly raise wages for faculty, including adjunct faculty. And I can go into more detail if you want, but
no. And I think we'll circle back to that for sure. But first, I want to create a few lines in the sand. Tanya, tell us what makes organizing at public universities different from organizing at private universities, because I think there might be some differences there that you guys are facing.
Well, in terms of organizing experience, I don't know much about organizing at public universities, but the legal system through the entire Brown decision and the various overturnings of the status of graduate workers at private universities has tried to emphasize the difference between workers at public universities and private universities, whereas I think the last NLRB decision in 2016 affirmed the fact that it's not all that different because graduate workers in public universities have been considered employees and members of unions for ages now. So in terms of the work they do, of course, there are differences in the working conditions, but in like the fact that the work they do is work, it really isn't different.
Right. And you mentioned the 2004 ruling regarding Brown University. Briefly describe that ruling for us, the National Relations Board ruling.
So I think the first National Labor Relations Board ruling on the subject of the status of graduate workers at private universities was in 2000, and that was an affirmative decision. It declared that graduate students were employees, but the Brown decision of 2004 overruled that, where it decided that graduate teaching assistants were not statutory employees, and therefore they could not be part of a bargaining unit. And that was really the Bush-era labor legislation overturning what had been in practice for a while.
So how did that impact Columbia's attempts at organizing?
So not having legal recognition, of course, affects organizing in the fact that it doesn't lend a kind of legal status. But the fact that the decision was again overturned with the Columbia decision in 2016 has been a pretty historic moment, not just for Columbia, but for graduate organizing across the country. Because since the Columbia decision, I think some 13 other campuses have taken off organizing. So having that legal recognition as workers definitely encourages organizing, though organizing also continues outside of the legal decision.
It's not. So it's pretty safe to say that 2004 ruling set a precedent for private institutions.
Well, it actually made it difficult for private institutions to organize in a sense, because
right.
private institutions like NYU could then refuse to bargain with unions that they had already bargained with before.
Right. Sean, tell us about the adjunct project.
Yeah, the adjunct project, which I'm a coordinator of, there's about four of us, and we're chartered by the Doctoral Students Council at the Graduate Center. I always like to call it like a small independent organizing shop. We report to the Doctoral Students Council, which is the main legislative body of the Grad Center student body. And we work with the PSC in many ways, and we also work on our own issues, because importantly, not all of our wage and working conditions are actually addressed through our collective bargaining agreement through the PSC with CUNY management. For instance, fellowships, stipends.
The PFC being the...
PSC being the Professional Staff Congress, exactly. The main body, which is about 30,000 people strong. So we do more localized campaigns at the Graduate Center around things like fellowship money. There's a lot of inequities among the fellowships that are being provided to students across the student body. And we also do things trying to raise other issues to the level of the president and the provost. And of course, we're also engaged in various union PSC, Professional Staff Congress initiatives, such as the current demand for 7K minimum starting salary for adjunct faculty in the next bargaining.
$7,000 is a starting minimum salary, which leads to my next question. What are the salaries looking like these days for adjunct professors per class?
Well, the minimum is about $3,200. The average is about $3,500. So we'd be talking about, doubling if the average is $3,500 to $7,000.
I'm D.W. Gibson, speaking with Columbia PhD candidate Tanya Bhattacharya and Sean M. Kennedy, a PhD candidate. For English at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. Listeners, do you have experiences as TA research assistants? Or are you currently adjuncting? Call us at 212-433-9692 or tweet us at WNYC Midday. So I want to ask both of you to describe what your typical workload might look like in a week. Tanya, let's start with you. Tell us what sort of a workload looks like for you.
Well, there are broadly speaking two kinds of labor, teaching assistants and research assistants, but though there are other kinds as well, there are course graders, there are graduate instructors, and the labor load depends on what kind of work you're doing. If you're a graduate instructor, you do much more work because you design the entire course. Formally, TAs and RAs are paid for 20 hours of labor per week, but that is absolutely not representative. Everyone does more than 20 hours a week. And the fact that that is not regulated, like that there is no cap or no calculation or even the notion that the amount of time you spend on work is what, you know, we don't really calculate how many hours we spend, but well over 20 hours of work per week would be in terms of time. And in terms of labor, if you're a teaching assistant, you do sections for undergraduates, you sometimes set exams, you grade exams, you hold office hours, you take all your students' questions and doubts and concerns. If you're a research assistant, actually your PIs, your project investigators' research is tied in with yours, and all the federal funds that Columbia University gets mm-hmm. is tied in with the labor of research assistants. So,
Sam, how long have you been working as an adjunct professor at CUNY?
Well, I've been working here for 6 years, both as an adjunct professor and also as a graduate teaching employee, which is a slightly different categorization, a graduate employee similar to what Tanya's speaking about at Columbia. And so I've taught a number of classes. And I should say that we've actually done at the Adjunct Project an hours worked survey. It's an informal sample of adjuncts and graduate teaching fellows, but people are working as many as 30 hours a week in addition to the 3 hours or 4 hours are paid for per course. So,
and what are your biggest concerns with the current labor practices there as they are now?
Well, I mean, similar to what Tanya was speaking about, there's no policy or guidance around class caps, for instance. So I could be teaching a class for 30 students, somebody else who's a graduate employee in my same university system could be teaching a class for, 120 people, for instance, right? So that's like a great inequity even there. Even teaching 30 students, right, as an adjunct professor or as a graduate employee, still quite a lot, especially if you're teaching introductory courses, which require a lot of additional work. And that's what most adjuncts and graduate teaching employees are teaching.
So we have a caller on the line who has some questions that tie into this line of conversation. Sam in Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Hello. Good afternoon, everyone.
Hello.
Hi.
Good afternoon.
I feel the system pretty well. I've been teaching actually in CUNY for 12 years. And that started as a graduate student at the Grad Center. And since completing my PhD a few years ago. And you know, I just love working at CUNY and working with the student body there. And I teach on several campuses. The thing that is, you know, indicative of, I guess, higher education at this moment generally is that there really aren't paths for welcoming me into the full-time fold. So as far as having some stability as an adjunct, I suppose I enjoy some stability as an adjunct for just having been there for as long as I have, and for the fact that there aren't full-time lines being opened up in departments, generally speaking, as people retire and creating a path to citizenship, so to speak, you know, which is the way I describe it. So, you know, in terms of union efforts, I mean, I've been a member of the union, and now with the recent Supreme Court stuff, you know, we've had to actually take more of an active role to be a member in the union. While the union tries to provide some protections for us and some health care options and things, there are some things that are totally untenable, such as, you know, if you're a stable adjunct, and this is beyond grad school, right? If you're in grad school, a few years back at the CUNY Graduate Center, there was an effort made to create a good health care system for grad students who were teaching as adjuncts. Now, post that, there's you're in sort of a different route as a member of the union and as a stable adjunct if you're teaching two courses per semester or more.
Those are some great points. Those are some great points you raised, Sam. I want to go to our folks here in studio. Sean, is healthcare a concern? Is that something that comes up in some of your organizing?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think as a caller just pointed out, there is a difference between what you get as a graduate employee, as a student at the Graduate Center, which is pretty good, except for people who have chronic conditions. I mean, they reach their deductible really quickly and then have to start paying out of pocket, which is a major issue that people are talking about right now. I haven't had a lot of experience with the adjunct health insurance that the caller was referring to, but my understanding is that it's not as good as he was pointing out, mm-hmm. right, what you could have as a student. So there is still work that needs to be done there.
Yeah, and as a student at Columbia, you don't get dental health, so it's very basic health things that are not provided. So it's not only a question of not having enough coverage, but also not having security. Like, they can give you dental 1 year and then withdraw it at the next semester without any prior communication, and that has happened before at Columbia. So it's a really basic requirement at Columbia, at least for grad workers.
Mm-hmm. Well, and tell me, Tanya, how has Columbia, in general terms, reacted to this organizing initiative at the school?
Very poorly. I think they're going very much against, they're trying to act like this is not a movement that they're going to lose sooner, if not later. I think by now 8 private universities have agreed to bargain and do the democratic thing. But Columbia voted a 72% yes vote, saying we are union and we want to bargain. And Columbia has used the legal system, and all their money has gone to paying Proskauer and Rose.
A law firm.
An anti-union law firm mm-hmm. that they've hired, and that all these other universities who are fighting their organizing unions have hired. So instead of paying graduate workers better, you know, wages, they've been spending millions of dollars, and we don't know how much because they will not divulge how much they're paying their lawyers. So it's been an extremely poor and anti-democratic reaction.
Keeping lawyers employed. So why do you think they want to wait until the union files an unfair labor practice claim to settle the matter in court?
I think a great part of their game is to delay and, like, push this matter as far as they can. I think they were really hoping for the Trump Labor Board to rule in their favor, but all of the other universities pulled their petitions, so they didn't have that opportunity. So I think delaying is a great part of the game, but at this point, they also know, because Harvard started bargaining 1 day after we stopped our most recent strike. So I think that affects Columbia's decision and what they're going to do next. But they don't really have a great anti-union strategy, clearly, because it hasn't worked so well.
Well, and tell us about that strike.
We were on strike for a week in the last week of April. It was timed to be with the last week of classes, and it was our first strike, and it was like a sort of call to Columbia that we are ready to do more, because if Columbia doesn't come to its senses soon, we'll be on strike again. And we struck on the 20-hour working week, and we had over, I think, 1,500 people in total out on the picket lines for 4 hours every day of the week. And it was a fantastic result, actually. And there's been word that it was quite crippling in several departments, because all teaching assistants and research assistants stopped, like, a significant chunk of work for that week.
So. Right. I'm D.W. Gibson, and I'm speaking with Sean Kennedy, a PhD candidate at the Graduate Center of CUNY, and Tanya Bhattacharya, a Columbia University PhD candidate, about the ongoing efforts to organize graduate student labor and adjunct professors for the final installment of our series, The Costs of Higher Ed. I'm D.W. Gibson, and I'm speaking with Sean Kennedy and Tanya Bhattacharya for our series, The Costs of Higher Ed. So, universities have argued that this is an educational experience and shouldn't be considered labor. I'd love to get your responses to that, Tanya.
Well, in the first instance, it's ridiculous to pose those two as mutually exclusive. Through history, apprentices have both worked and learned simultaneously, and we continue to do both. And importantly, faculty recognize that as well. A significant portion of faculty at Columbia University's campus have signed petitions saying that we see you as both students and colleagues, and that the work we do is impossible without your labor. So that is not a real contradiction. It's just something that the university creates. And also, the fact is, without the labor that graduate students and adjuncts and postdocs do, the university wouldn't run. If graduate students stop working, all the classes and the research done by the university really does stop. So there's no contradiction. We're students and workers.
Yeah, I agree 100%. The only thing that I would add is that we're also producing tons of value for the universities, right? I mean, we're getting in external, you know, grants. Our work is featured, right, in brochures and promotional documents, all sorts. And with the Graduate Center in particular, which is chasing the prestige of Columbia and NYU, for instance, you know, we're creating all this value for them that also should be part of the conversation, frankly.
Right. We have a couple of callers that have comments along these lines. Let's go to Pat in Wharton, New Jersey. Pat, you're on the air.
Hi. It's a pleasure being with you.
Thanks for being with us. Tell us what's on your mind.
You know, my issue is I've worked for 10 years at a place. We have no federal labor law protections. Like, even me speaking out now, I could just not get the contract next time.
Right.
There's that. But then I teach a course that a full-timer teaches, and he gets paid four times as much as I do. And he has a full medical package and all the whole wax of beans, you know.
Right.
And we're also limited to only 11 credits, and it says that that's like 29 hours of work, and it certainly is not. Mm-hmm.
Thanks for sharing that, Pat. You know, it does raise the possibility of tensions within faculty. I mean, this inequality there is probably something you navigate on a regular basis, yes?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I can't speak for faculty, but what this reminds me of is the fear and how risky it is for many people. I'm an international student, for example, and organizing international students has been really tricky because everyone is afraid to be the one who stands up and speaks out. But the most empowering thing about the union has been to realize that we really are stronger when we all speak out together. And it's great to see increasing numbers of international students and how much the union has already done for
right.
international students. So.
We have a caller who has an interesting track. They were a tenured professor turned adjunct. James in Portland, Oregon, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I have a whole history that has been through all parts of it. I was a part of the Wisconsin TA union and strike in 1970. Then I became an adjunct at San Francisco State. Then I became a tenured professor in Connecticut for 29 years, and now I'm back to being an adjunct. And I can tell you that I teach exactly the same course now as I taught in Connecticut for 1/6 the amount of money at Portland State University.
Tremendous.
But one of the issues that I think is that I've noticed everywhere is that tenured faculty, tenure track faculty, do not have solidarity with adjunct faculty, and that's one of the reasons that they permit this system to go on.
Does that ring true for you, Sean? I mean, that to me, that's a central question. Is there support from tenured track faculty? And if so, what does that support look like? And if there's a lack of support, how does that dynamic play out?
Yeah, no, for sure. It's a great question. It's definitely key to some of the organizing challenges. I mean, number one, and I should, you know, Professional Staff Congress is not alone in this, right? Like all the faculty unions that are out there are full-time or dominated if they also have adjuncts in them. Sometimes adjuncts are in separate locals. But, you know, the adjunctification of U.S. higher ed has happened on the watch, right, of full-time dominated unions, right? So that's number one. Number two, you know, it's highly unequal, and I see it as an example of different types of hierarchies in the world today, in society today, right? So in fact, full-time faculty are actually benefiting, right, from the exploited wages and poor working conditions of adjunct faculty in various ways, right? And so I do think that full-time faculty, and there are exceptions, you know, who understand the links that, right, the exploitation of the lowest tier of workers' wages affects everybody's wages, for instance. There are some allies out there, but in general, I think similar to what Tanya was saying, there's a lot of fear, right, that they're not going to have what they've known for their entire time in the professoriate.
But and they have such a security, right? I mean, isn't the idea that they have a security in their position as tenured professors that they could sort of have more voices for the people they teach next to?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think organizing does this in the sense it changes the campus as a space. Mm-hmm. So faculty feel more and more called upon. I think Kristen Ross, faculty at NYU, came to our picket line and she said, this is the moment for faculty to choose whether they're faculty or management. And I think many faculty don't like being called on in that sense, but more and more faculty do see that it is really the moment for solidarity. And I think administrative strategy is always to tell you how all our labor is different. So, you know, tenured faculty does different work from adjunct faculty, or adjunct faculty does different work from graduate workers. And organizing really does the opposite, tells the opposite story, which is that a lot of what we do is similar and crucial work. And I think this is the only way it's going to change.
We have a caller on the line who went to NYU, Savannah in Westchester. You're on the air.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. So I was the beneficiary of the organizing work that was done at NYU. I went to school there as a graduate student in a master's level public health program from 2002 to 2004. And I got into both Columbia and NYU, but NYU offered me a research assistantship position, which was an amazing package for me, because I basically got my graduate work paid for by working, like you said, 20 hours, and I got a healthcare and I had a stipend on top of tuition remission. So it was an amazing package for me, and I just want to encourage everybody to organize all you can, because this, you know, to me, I think I would have gone to Columbia just because they had a better program. I ended up at NYU because of this. I do think it changes the landscape for schools, for communities, for, you know, who's going where, and, you know, the what I did working with that professor as a research assistant was really important for my own career, because I ended up working, you know, on a grant from the Public Health Department of New York City, and it was a really fabulous experience. And I just hope that we can bring this level of organizing all over.
Right. I mean, that's a good point in terms of a factor that people might be considering when they're deciding which institution to go to. Sean, talk to us about the line from being a PhD student to being an adjunct rather than a tenure track.
Wow. Well, that's a big question. And talk about fear. That's what most, right, up-and-coming emerging scholars, as we're called, fear, right, is that we're actually not going to get the tenure-track job because there's so few tenure-track jobs out there these days, which, by the way, has been a long-standing pattern going back all the way to the early 70s. People think about it as a more recent thing, but it's been going on for quite some time.
The shrinkage of
the
those.
The shrinkage, yeah. Well, but there's always, but even the Modern Language Association, which is like my main academic association, was, you know, rallying around resolutions in the early 70s, like decrying how few full-time tenure track positions there were, even in the early 70s.
So going back decades.
It's been going on for quite some time. I mean, generally, a lot of it's luck, a lot of it's privilege, right? A lot of it's about one's positionality in terms of hierarchies of race and gender and national, international status, things like this for sure play a huge role. Most people, if they're lucky, they'll get a tenure track job maybe a couple years down the road. They might not get it the first time they go out in the market. I'm going out in the market for the first time this fall. We'll see what happens. I might be able to get a visiting assistant professorship my first time out. Maybe if I'm lucky, I'll get a postdoc my first time out. You know, but it's still, as Tanya was saying earlier, it's still all very uncertain and all precarious, right? These are all contingent forms of labor. If all those options don't work out, then I'll end up adjuncting in CUNY, right? Of course, then you start to face a bit of an unstated penalty for working as an adjunct, right? Which is that elite institutions in particular, but I think many of them don't want you, right? If you're an adjunct with a PhD, right? There's a stigma that's attached to this as well, so.
Which creates, I believe we refer to that as a rock and a hard place.
Indeed.
Tanya, how did Columbia graduate students come to decide to unionize through the United Auto Workers Union?
It was a decision. This was made before I got involved with organizing myself, but it was decided by people who came together to have conversations. And the United Auto Workers represents a huge number of academic workers across the country, and they also represent support staff on our campus. So we're part of the same local that represents support staff who work at Columbia. They also represent Barnard contingent faculty who got a contract recently. So these were all factors, but the decisions were made by people who were involved in the early organizing and took care of all of these. Yeah, the reason being that it represents, UW represents academic workers not only all across the country, but also in New York City and on our campus, and that made them strong.
Do you see there an opportunity to create solidarity between quote-unquote white-collar workers and blue-collar workers?
Absolutely, and I think this has been such a learning process when we see nurses who turn out because Columbia will not bargain with them and not give them basic things like new uniforms. It makes you think not only of how Columbia is exploiting you, but how it's exploiting all forms of precarious labor. And one of Columbia's stances has been, it's not about us being anti-union. We regularly negotiate with unions, but as all of our brother and sister unions have regularly pointed out, Columbia is anti-union as a policy. So it isn't just about grad workers' unions being special. They discriminate against all kinds of workers. And this is why organizing as part of unions that represent all kinds of workers is a really learning moment for grad workers in particular.
Right. And Tanya, you know, you mentioned earlier that you're an international student, and we learned in an earlier segment that universities view foreign students as income generators. Sean, is this the case with PhD students as well? Is it safe to say that?
I think it depends. I mean, Tanya's sort of shaking her head, so I think I want to defer to her.
Yeah.
PhD students, they are not sources of income. I think international master students are a massive source of income, but international students, it might be different at CUNY, but at Columbia, they're funded PhDs. So.
Yeah, we have funded PhDs as well, and I do think the point is that masters, I got my master's degree actually at Rutgers in Newark, and there was a heavy, heavy, heavy number of international students there who are paying full tuition to go there, so I think that's precisely the moment. Yeah.
But I also think it's also undergraduate tuition that's massively being misused by the university. I mean, student debt is a problem in the country, and also Columbia graduates in particular pay astronomical sums of money. And where that money is going, clearly it's not going to the graduate instructors who are teaching the classes that these undergraduates are taking, but it's going to these law firms.
And I will just add, I think the money is there. It's just the budget priorities, right? The spending priorities of these institutions are so out of whack with anything that could look like fairness.
Sure. Well, and so many schools are experiencing areas of growth, never mind online education, right? So there are all kinds of revenue streams. Thank you guys so much for joining me today. This is a very important issue, and I hope we can bring it into the public discourse more. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
I'm D.W. Gibson, and I've been speaking with Sean Kennedy, a PhD candidate at the Graduate Center of CUNY, and Tanya Bhattacharya, a Columbia University PhD candidate, about ongoing efforts to organize graduate student labor and adjunct professors for the final installment of our series, The Costs of Higher Ed.